Welcome to the Independent Advisors Podcast, where we dive into the world of stocks, tradable markets, and financial planning with Jessup Wealth Management's Chief Investment Officer, Mark McEvely, and CEO, Matt Jessup. You'll hear tips, tricks, and strategies to address your financial well-being, and most importantly, conveyed in a way that everyone can understand. Here are your hosts, Mark and Matt.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode 243 of the Independent Advisors Podcast, where Matt Jessup and I, Mark McEvely, bring you everything you need to know from the past week in the world of financial markets and financial planning. This week, Nick Whitaker is back on the show to fill in for Matt. So, Nick, thanks for coming back on.
Good to be here, as always.
Quickly, we will review the month-to-date and year-to-date performance of the major market indices that we track. This data is from YCharts and as of the market close on March 13th. S&P 500 index up 1.4% for the month and up 8.3% for the year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 0.1% for the month and up 3.6% for the year. The NASDAQ Composite Index up 0.5% for the month, up 7.8% for the year. The Russell 2000 Small Cap Index up 1% for the month and 2.5% for the year. And the Vanguard All World Ex United States ETF up 3% for the month and up 4.4% for the year. 3-month treasury rate sitting at 5.48%, the 2-year treasury rate at 4.61%, and the 10-year treasury rate at 4.19%. Big headlines, current events from the past week, Nick. The biggest one was the CPI data that came out on Tuesday this week on March 12th. Total CPI was up 0.4% month over month as expected. Core CPI, which excludes food and energy, was up 0.4% month over month. The briefing.com estimate consensus was 0.3%. Total CPI was up 3.2% year over year versus 3.1% in January, and core CPI was up 3.8% year over year versus 3.9% in January. And the key takeaway here, I think, Nick, is, you know, there's an isolated impact of the shelter index, which is expected to lessen in the coming months given the moderation in rent prices. So I think you're going to really start to see inflation moderate unless, you know, other parts of inflation start to pick back up. But we've been talking about this for the past really 6 months, is that shelter and rent is really a lagging piece of data that we should start to see benefit from that over the next couple of months.
And I think the core CPI is really what the Fed and what the market's going to be focusing on too.
Yeah, for sure. So hopefully good news to come on that front. But moving ahead to tweets, articles, and research from this week, Nick, first thing I had was an article from Adam Turnquist from LPL on March 7th titled, "Who Do Markets Want to Win the Election?" So this is the hot talk or the talk of the town here, at least, you know, meeting with clients, everyone wants to know what our thoughts are on the election and, you know, who's going to win and who do we want to win. So I found this this article written by Adam pretty interesting. So he says, coming into Super Tuesday, which was last week, the S&P 500 was up over 7%, and history suggests this could be a good sign for President Biden's chance of re-election. Since 1976, when Super Tuesday first surfaced, market performance ahead of the primaries has correlated closely with election results. While acknowledging the limited data, when the S&P 500 was higher ahead of Super Tuesday, the incumbent president's political party won the election 4 out of the last 5 times. And when stocks were lower into Super Tuesday, the incumbent president's party lost the election 6 out of the last 7 times. The market has been right 10 of the last 12 instances. And again, this is going back to 1976. Jenna will throw this graph kind of up on the this data set up on the YouTube page and in our show notes. Again, history going back to 1976. Is this a perfect indicator? No. Is it a small sample set? Yes. But you know, the market was higher going into Super Tuesday. So in terms of that, it looks like the scales would tip towards President Biden. But not so fast. We're going to have a data point here that tips the scales in favor of Trump here in a second. In terms of election year returns, Adam says, the S&P 500 has generated an average price return of 7.3%, excluding dividends, during all election years since 1952. And if you're a client, I apologize. You probably heard me say this in recent client meetings, but I've quoted that stat several times. However, when election years are positive, as they tend to be 83% of the time, the average price return jumps to 12.2%. The market, however, appears to be welcoming the higher probability of a Trump victory, evidenced by a rising correlation between his chances of winning the election and the S&P 500 over the last few months. In contrast, President Biden's predictit.org odds have slid lower since the start of the year, and as a result are negatively correlated to S&P 500 performance. So we have a little graph here that Jenna will throw up on the video and in our show notes as well. This kind of shows the correlation of Trump odds and Biden odds with the performance of the S&P 500 going back to the fall of 2023. So Nick, you know, we know that this stuff is really a toss up. You know, we can have all the data on this stuff that we want. Nothing's going to be perfect in predicting the election, just how we can't predict markets, right? But yeah. Interesting to get one perspective using data from the past.
Yeah, the correlations is particularly interesting to me.
It is.
With the S&P 500, obviously the bias there from working in the industry, but
right.
Yeah, it's very tough to predict public opinion, as we've seen in numerous of elections in the past that have been very close. So
right.
Who knows?
Anything can happen.
Yep.
Next thing I had, Nick, was a Barron's magazine cover. So this was the most recent Barron's magazine cover. This was on March 11th. And the magazine cover says "Bet on the Bull," and Jenna will throw this up on the YouTube page. The picture is a set of bull horns ripping through a magazine cover. So, you know, people on social media were freaking out. They were like, "Oh, I guess the party's over." Yeah. You know, Barron's is bullish, but I think looking back, I'm pretty sure, and Ryan Dietrich did some work on this, The Economist is the one that usually, yeah, you know, top ticks the markets, and yeah, when they're super bullish, and Barron's is kind of like 50-50. Yeah. You know, Ryan pointed to a magazine cover, I think back in the fall of this year, and alluding to the fact that it was time to buy bonds, and it was the strongest 2-month period for bonds in quite a long time. So I don't think this is something to get too concerned about or wave the white flag just yet, but definitely something that's interesting to see if Barron's is right or wrong on this. But you know, for this reason, this is why we don't make predictions, just kind of follow the market and follow price and data. But always interesting and intriguing to see what happens after we see stuff like this.
Yeah. You almost wish that just magazines would not do things like this.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So
but, Barron's is, I think, I don't read Barron's or The Economist very closely.
I don't either.
I have read pieces from the magazines. I don't have a subscription to them, but from my understanding of the, you know, overarching point of both magazines, I would say that Barron's is a little bit more financially kind of up to date, so to speak, maybe.
Yeah.
The Economist can be a little bit more historical.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I'd love to chat with someone who's the decision maker of who, you know, who decides what's on the magazine cover. Like, I wonder if they have like
chief
marketing person that like lays out different images for them to pick every month. But yeah, that'd be interesting. Last thing I had, Nick, was a tweet from Unusual Whales on March 6th. And they said millions of Americans could soon see lower credit card bills after a federal rule that caps late fees at $8 a month. This was finalized by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which estimates that that change will save households $10 billion a year, per the New York Times. And they also state that late fees cost American households more than $14 billion a year, according to the CFPB. So something that's, I think, welcome news for everybody, because I think people feel like they've been getting ripped off by banks and credit card companies for a long period of time. So this is interesting to see if this actually does happen, but good news on the credit card front for consumers.
Yeah, that's a lot of savings in the grand scheme of things. So this is great.
Yeah.
A little win for the U.S. consumer, which we know powers the economy. So
correct. Wonderful. Correct. And speaking of the consumer and, you know, the average American wage and what's going on with that, I think this flows nicely into your first piece.
Yes, this rolls excellently into my first piece on U.S. real average hourly earnings. This is research from Charlie Bellello. He says the following: after a record 25 consecutive months of negative real wage growth, wages have now outpaced inflation on a year-over-year basis for 10 straight months. This is a great sign for the American worker and hopefully continues. And we'll throw this chart up here, and we love Charlie's charts. He does a really good job of annotating them. So you could see the negative wage growth and, you know, the 10 months of an uptick there. So, you know, in positive territory year-over-year, looking good.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that people have kind of, you know, scratched their head on over the past couple of years is they're like, well, if inflation is this high and you know, prices are going through the roof, why isn't the stock market doing worse, or why isn't the economy doing worse? And I think this is one of the reasons, is that for the most part, wages have kind of kept up with inflation, you know. Ever really since COVID, the power had transferred back to employees rather than employers, that they could demand a higher wage and get paid it, just because the pool of workers was smaller and the demand for workers was higher.
Thank you, all the baby boomers who retired. That made that easier for the economy, because that is a big piece of it.
Yeah,
the
demographic, so I think,
shift.
You know, this is a huge reason why, you know, a lot of people haven't felt inflation to the effect that they might have in the past, or the last time inflation was this high, is because wages have done a pretty good job with keeping up with inflation and price increases. So I think this is a huge reason why the economy is actually still pretty strong right now.
Yeah, 100% agree. Yeah. Moving on to my second piece today is a piece on momentum stocks that are in favor. This is a tweet from Michael Cantro. He's a chief investment strategist at Piper Sandler. He says the following: the weight of high momentum stocks in the U.S. market has never been this high over the past 100 years. There's a chart that we'll throw up here. It's one of those very up and down charts. They're not beautiful to look at. I'm sorry, but this is an interesting piece. And you can see here that we're at an all-time high with some of these momentum stocks, and, you know, look at the past periods where there's been exuberance with momentum names: COVID, 2000, the Nifty 50, 1929, to call out a few. And so really what I think this is being driven by is a lot of AI and a lot of semiconductor chips. There's been a lot of talk on the market about that. I'm not overly concerned by this chart. I think this chart is more kind of calling it out and saying, hey, just be aware of this. I think this chart is an excellent piece of data which supports the idea that we could see a pullback in the next few months.
Yeah, exactly. And when we're, I think it's important to define momentum for people. It's like when we're talking about, you know, momentum stocks, what's the differentiator between a momentum stock and a non-momentum stock? And we're talking about momentum, we're looking at performance over a look back period of a certain amount of time, right? So most popular is, you know, the rate of change of a stock over the past 12 months, but could also be over the last 3 months or the last 6 months or the last 2 years or a combination of any of those, right? So there are you know, strategies out there that use 3, 6, 12, 24-month look-back periods and trade based on the performance of those. They take, you know, the top 10 names and buy those in a portfolio, right?
Yeah, they factor out on the index. So that's how, like, you can find ETFs out there that are, like, S&P momentum.
Yeah.
And they build factors that, you know, based on all the data points that you just said, and then they'll basically, like, weight it, and they'll say, hey, we're going to take the top 20% of... based on those factors, and that's how we'll build our index, and that's so that'll be like the momentum,
right? So
keep,
I
keep going. Sorry,
you know, so I think, you know, if someone were to look up the holdings in any momentum ETF, you know, you're gonna have semiconductors as top holdings,
AI.
You know, Nvidia, yeah. AMD, Broadcom, and then AI stocks. You know, so I don't think you know, necessarily this is something to be too concerned about, but you know, it wouldn't surprise me if there is rotation and some of these names pull back significantly just because of the run-up that they had. But that doesn't mean that the entire market needs to falter as well, because we could see a rotation instead of a massive pullback to have, you know, these momentum stocks kind of take a back seat. So
exactly. And there's one more point that I want to make for listeners on this. I want them to think about in context of history, particularly as it pertains to momentum stocks and momentum strategies, is I want you to think about the drastic change in machine learning and what the industry calls black box trading, essentially algorithmic, high frequency trading, where you've got coders, and there's, we've talked about it before, Rentech, DE Shaw, there's a lot of them, basically quantitative trading that has surged and takes up a large portion of the market over the past 20 years. That's going to make these numbers bigger and more exacerbated, which is why I think in 50 years, the peaks of this chart are going to look different.
Right.
So I'm not overly concerned by the recent peaks here in the momentum stocks. I think if anything, it signals that if we're in a healthy market, we can expect to see a pullback at some point among some of those momentum names.
Yeah, I would agree. It's not very fair to compare, you know, back to the 50s or the 30s based on now, just because of the, you know, popularity of high frequency trading and, you know, momentum strategies, technical trading, software, technology.
It's
like comparing apples to oranges.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like comparing a spaceship to, you know, the first car ever made. It's not comparable.
Right.
So
that's
just
a good point.
Keep that in mind with this chart. It's, you're going to see a lot in the news, and I've seen a lot in the news about, oh, like bubble talk, and oh, is this, when it comes to the momentum, and this is a great chart that shows like, okay, it's similar to the Nifty 50. And I read up a little bit more about the Nifty 50, and you know, knowing as much as I know about tracking quant money and how quick it moves and the way that a lot of algorithms will work, that's a huge piece to consider.
Yeah, so, for sure.
The last piece I have is it's a tweet from Brian G at Alpha Charts. It's about the business cycle and market rotation. There are going to be two charts that we throw up here. The first one is just a chart that basically shows where we are in the business cycle relative to the kind of like the textbook asset allocation rotation and rotations. So this is kind of like what you would see in a textbook. There are different versions of this chart, and you know, you can find it a bunch of different ways, but I think Brian pulled this from Stock Charts actually. And it shows you in different stages of the business cycle. So when you think business cycle, think the economic situation in the economy, how we are, you know, earnings, unemployment, inflation, et cetera, et cetera. So as the business cycle kind of expands and contracts, which asset allocations you expect to underperform and outperform. So the green arrows are the outperform, and obviously the red are the underperform. So we're going to throw that on the screen for you so you can kind of like take that in quickly. And then Brian G says the following, where in the cycle might we be? Likely stage 3 to 4. And then he throws up this other chart, which takes those three different asset classes, stocks with the S&P 500, DBC, which is an index for commodities, and IEI, which is an ETF for bonds. And he charts those out, and then using those stages that we previously just showed you, he basically like charted that over top of it, where you can kind of like estimate the future of where we are in the business cycle. So I thought this was kind of a cool chart, a nice take. He's clearly a stock charts user, which we like. So yeah, 3 to 4, which is, you know, a good place to be from an economic point of view and from a market point of view as well. You know, if we're in stage 3 or 4, things are looking up, right? We're in the middle of, you know, just like Barron said, right? Bet on the bull. So just like that previous chart I showed you was like, oh, momentum stocks, is there a bubble with AI, is AI overbought? And look at it relative to Nifty 50 in 1929. It's like, there's also data out here like this that points quite to the opposite. Things are healthy. Things are looking up. So any thoughts?
Yeah, no, I would just say that, you know, looking at how often these different cycles happen, it seems like we've had a lot of what I would call kind of like mini cycles over the past 4 years. So I think it'd be unlikely for that trend to continue. You know,
I agree.
We've been through, you know, it seems like a lot of stage 5 and 6s, which is the market top and in decline, obviously in 2020 and then in 2022 shortly after that. So I think the probability of going through another decline here in the near future, and when I say near future, I define that as within the next year, I think it's unlikely, not improbable, but you know, putting these market cycles to different time periods in the market is helpful because you can start to see which assets outperform and underperform during different stages. Is this going to be perfect? No. Are there going to be, you know, times where you're in stage 3 or stage 4 and, you know, bonds are outperforming? Yeah, you're going to have that. It's not going to be perfect. Yeah. But generally, it just makes sense, right? You're in expansion. The economy's doing well. Risk assets are generally going to do better. Stocks. And then when you're in decline, you know, typically bonds buoy the portfolio a little bit. Obviously, different situation this time around after 2020 when the interest rate situation was a little different.
Yep.
And that's
why we call it a textbook.
Yeah, textbook. It's not real life.
It's not real life. That's what you read. But you know, if you go based off of textbooks and you simply use the textbook to follow the market, and you're going to get burned because
you'll learn that
time and time again
pretty quickly.
Yeah, there's always wrinkles. Oh, well, the textbook would have been right if this. And it's like, okay, well, it wasn't.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
yeah. Now, it's a good chart. Brian G has some really good stuff. He's on Twitter, and I believe he has a Substack too. So I like to read his stuff. He does some really nice analysis every week. So. Yeah. Well, Nick, thanks for filling in for Matt this week. We're going to go ahead and bring in Taylor for the financial planning topic of the week. So we'll see you, I'm sure, in the not too distant future.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So Taylor Ledbetter is going to be joining us for our financial planning topic of the week, and going to talk about something that's almost as controversial, in my opinion, as the presidential election, which is Social Security. So Taylor, thanks for coming back on.
Yeah, it's good to be back. Today, I'm just going to be talking about if Social Security raises their normal retirement age, what that will do to future retirees. Because I know that's been a very popular topic lately in the news.
It has.
So I'll be referencing an article that I read by Steve Vernon. So for a really long time, normal retirement age was actually around 65. And it wasn't until 1983 that we got our current setup that we have right now. So just as a reminder, for people born between 1943 and 1954, normal retirement age is 66. And then for people born in 1960 and after, that age is 67.
Right. So there is a precedent for your full retirement age increasing.
Yes.
Over time, which I know isn't the thing that people want to hear, but I'll let you get to it. But we are where we are in the Social Security situation and the trust fund and everything. So action will need to be taken, but have a couple of years before it needs to be. But I would expect some changes over the next several years.
Yeah, I think they're going to have to make some changes.
Yeah.
And I think a popular question is, you know, why would they raise that retirement age? And there's really a few different reasons, that trust fund definitely being one of them. But people are also living a lot longer. So that's creating solvency problems for Social Security. And then, like you said, that trust fund, it is expected to run out by 2034 if no action is taken.
Right.
So there have been some proposals. The first one we'll talk about is raising normal retirement age to 70. So according to this article, it said this would reduce the value of benefits for affected retirees by about 20%.
Wow.
So that's a pretty big percentage.
Yeah, it is. It is. When you're talking about, you know, a large portion of a lot of Americans' income, yeah, it's a large percentage.
Yeah, a lot of people rely, you know, solely on Social Security and retirement for income.
Right.
Another proposal is increasing the FICA taxes, more so for the affluent taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
So for people who aren't super familiar with FICA taxes, that is just your Social Security and your Medicare tax.
Yep.
Collectively, it's 15.3%. Half is paid by your employer, and then half is paid by you.
Correct.
So they've just talked about increasing that.
Right. And I've heard, you know, estimates, and again, I don't know how accurate this stuff is, but from the things I've read, it's only an increase of a couple percentage points to FICA, that they said they can, you know, fully fund Social Security for, you know, decades to come.
Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't surprise me if we do go down that road, or if a business makes over a certain amount of, you know, taxable income, that they're the ones that they get their FICA raise. So that could be something that's very possible.
Yeah, because, you know, obviously it would be unfair to impose that onto the lower income individuals.
Correct.
Plus, it wouldn't make as big of a move.
Right.
If that was the rule.
Move the needle.
Exactly. Another proposal that's been discussed is a phase in / phase out for that normal retirement age. So kind of what I was referencing to what they did in 1983, they've talked about increasing that age from 67 to 69 over an 8-year period beginning in 2026. But for people who reach age 62 in 2033 or later, they would receive the full increase to age 69.
Okay.
But this proposal would grandfather people in who've attained age 62 by 2025.
Okay. And if your head is spinning listening to all this, if you're a listener on the other side, we always like to tell our clients, hey, plan for your retirement as if there's going to be no Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do I think that's going to be the case? Absolutely not. Because I think any politician who proposes to get rid of Social Security altogether is political suicide.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think there's a chance of that happening really at all. But, you know, it could get to the point where one or several of these changes are put in place, or it, you know, changes to a needs-based system. So I think people should always save in their career, planning on them not having Social Security, because then it's just, you know, cream on top, right? If they do have that extra income from Social Security.
Yeah, definitely more of a supplement.
Correct.
And, you know, I think all three of the proposals we just talked about, any one of them could happen. I don't think one is more realistic than the other right now.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree.
So aside from reducing Social Security's long-term deficit, I do think there are some cons to these proposals. So people who rely on Social Security the most in retirement, I think, would be affected the most. Because it'd be a huge disadvantage for them if they had to work later, wait to file, especially if they're working very physically hard jobs, you know, raising that to 69 or maybe 70 at some point. That's a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And obviously for certain, you know, physical laboring jobs, you know, normal retirement for those people might be late 50s or early 60s just because it takes so much of a toll on their body. Right. And I think, you know, bucketing all workers into the same category of, you know, quote, normal retirement age is not really the fairest way to do it. But you know, I don't know how the government would get around that.
Yeah, I agree. Because, you know, think of somebody who does work a very physically hard job and, you know, maybe they retire from that position in their late 50s and then they go work somewhere else.
Right.
You know, maybe it doesn't pay as much. If you collect Social Security and you work before your full retirement age, your benefits are reduced.
Right.
And so I think that's another disadvantage, especially for the lower income workers, because if they have to file because they need that extra income,
right,
that benefit's going to be reduced.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's not just reduced for that year. It's reduced, you know, permanently.
Correct.
You know, so, and that's the same thing. You know, you claim Social Security at 62, you know, you have a reduced benefit for the rest of your life, mm-hmm, rather than waiting until 65 or until 70 where you can maximize your benefit.
Right. Yeah. Most people can't wait that long.
Right. Right. Exactly.
But yeah, I just wanted to go through those different proposals and kind of give my thoughts on those, because I do think, you know, something is going to change in the next couple of years.
Yeah. The can's been kicked so far down the road on Social Security that, you know, before 2034, something needs to happen, right? So they need to figure this out one way or another. Again, I don't like making predictions, but just as a fun guess, my guess would be that they're going to increase FICA taxes on employers and see if they can, you know, kick the can down the road even further. I think that's how they're going to fund it. But I don't think Social Security is going away. I think there's been a lot of fear mongering in the media that it is going to go away. And, you know, you see political opponents, you know, spewing things like, well, he or she said that they're going to get rid of Social Security or they're going to cut your Social Security benefits. I don't think that's going to happen. I think there'd be anarchy if that were to happen. So I think that, you know, the easiest way for people to solve it is just raise taxes, right? Mm-hmm.
And then it doesn't affect the people as much who are actually
rely on it and need it. So, well, thanks Taylor for coming on and discussing this hot topic right now. Would love to have you on again if we get any movement or headway on this over the next couple of years. So it'll be interesting to see what route the government decides to go down. And thank you to everybody listening to episode 243 of the Independent Advisors Podcast. We will be back with you next week for episode 244.
Thank you for listening to the Independent Advisors Podcast. If you're interested in hearing more, hit the subscribe button so you can be notified every time a new episode gets released. Feel free to share with friends, family, and follow us on Twitter at Jessup Wealth, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Mark and Matt will continue to share beneficial information on these social media sites. Also, check out the podcast tab on their website. That's www.jessupwealthmanagement.com. There you'll find links to every episode of the Independent Advisors. Have questions or topics you want to discuss on the show? Message us on Twitter, LinkedIn, or send an email with the words questions and topics in the subject line to inquiries@jessupwealthmanagement.com. We'll talk about it right here on the podcast. Certain sections of this commentary may contain forward-looking statements based on reasonable expectations, estimates, projections, and assumptions. Forward-looking statements are not guarantees of future performance and involve certain risks and uncertainties, which are difficult to predict. All indices are unmanaged and are not available for direct investment by the public. Past performance is not indicative of future results. This podcast is provided for general informational purposes only and does not constitute either tax, legal, or financial advice. Although we do go to great lengths to make sure our information is accurate and useful, we recommend you consult a tax preparer, professional tax advisor, financial advisor, or lawyer regarding your specific circumstances. Investing involves risk, including the loss of principal. No strategy can guarantee any objective or goal will be achieved.